him destroy me and end up happier than ever? No way. He doesn't get to win.
Whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Gina! But I don't care, darling, because I love you. You've got to love me. Eat your brother.
Why do you eat people?
Not people. Brains. I can feel myself rot.
Sid, don't you blame the movies. Movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative.
Well, then. Wheel.
Do you go out with friends?
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm fine, Phil. How is thou?
Doing all right. And in the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Hey, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how are you?
Doing good.
Excellent. For folks who are curious who we are the Dark Discussions Podcast, which is www.darkdiscussions.com. It is the website for the network, which is the Dark Discussions News Network. That network includes many podcasts that most of your co-hosts on this podcast here participate in, including various other podcasts, side podcasts, television podcasts, shows, and things of that nature. But this is the first and original podcast that started in 2011, so a long time ago. We do have a website, an email, which is darkdiscussions@aol.com. Put in DDP and your subject, and then whatever your subject is, and we will read your email on the podcast. By putting DDP in the subject, we can search for DDP, which stands for Dark Discussions Podcast, and we'll know that your email is from one of our listeners rather than one of the marketing people or the advertiser or the screener people that send us stuff all the time. Also, we have a Facebook group, which is Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, which you can join in discussion. And today is March 14th, 2024, Pi Day is the running joke. We are here recording on that very important day, Pi Day. And we are letting people know the day and year we're recording, because some episodes are not necessarily released immediately. Some are put into the backlog to come out on a rainy day. Just in case we're sick or we have power problems or we're on vacation, and we still will have an episode readily available to be released, which is kind of funny because next week's episode, by the time you hear this episode, will have already come out, and that is a recording from 14 months ago. Significant Other was the movie. So sometimes they sit in the queue for 14 months.
I don't even remember that movie.
Yeah,
it was movie?
A Significant Other. It was the girl that starred in
the woods.
Yeah. The alien apocalypse thing, kind of.
I like how I narrowed it down with In the Woods, because there's just so few.
I knew exactly what he was talking about. I don't know what your
problem
is.
Yeah, that's the funny part.
But when I post episodes and you have to put tags, one of the tags that I seem to put on all the time is rural horror. Yes. And that one, I'm sure, will be rural horror.
Oh, that one. Okay. I remember now.
Yeah. So that's the reason why we give the timestamps because some of our listeners, like Pam, are always curious when we record because some of the stuff may be outdated, like new releases or what video game we're playing or whatnot. But it's all good because a lot of times people go back and listen to episodes from 2, 3, 4 years ago, except for the ones 150 that I haven't posted up yet that I have to repost.
150 of them, Phil. Come on.
But yeah, we got people that were downloading the last Resident Evil movie episode, Howard's Mill. We're still getting people downloading that. It's kind of interesting. So we're getting people.
They might check out our episode on The Omen if it was available.
Yeah, I got to reload that one. That's one of the 150 that have to be reloaded. Anyway, so what do we do here on Dark Discussions Podcast? Basically, we talk about movies, so genre films. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mystery, grindhouse, arthouse, midnight movies, foreign language films, cult films, drive-in fare, and the like. Basically, we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. And it is early in the year. Usually, at this point, we do a lot of VOD films or Patreon picks or even films from last year, like that Australian film that we still haven't gotten back to. I forget the name of it. What's it called again? It's kind of another generic title. The one about the body horror Australian film from last year that everybody thought was a top 10 film. What was it called? Anyone? Anyone? Barrett, the one that you forgot about and you forgot to put on your list.
It was body horror that I forgot to put on my list?
There was an Australian horror film from last year that you said, if I had remembered, I would have put it as a top 10 horror.
Talk to Me?
Yeah, well, that's it, yeah.
That's not really body horror.
Yeah, that's why I was confused. Yeah, not body horror.
It's the only one I quickly pulled up my top 10. It's the only Australian film I could identify.
Yeah.
I know it was some generic title, though. But, yeah, we were supposed to do an episode on that. It's still in the works, but when we have a break, we'll probably do it. Anyway, I think that's pretty much our house screening for tonight. And tonight we're going to do a big film because it is now almost the end of March. And with that stated, Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, try that again. Tonight, we're talking about a movie currently in theaters, Dune Part 2.
I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes, then great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
Deal with this prophet. Send assassins.
Hey, Robert. He's psychotic.
I see possible futures all at once. And in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through.
Form of power that our world has not yet seen. The ultimate power.
I want you to know I will love you as long as I breathe.
You will never lose me as long as you stay who you are.
Consider what you're about to do, Paul Atreides.
Silence!
How they enslave us!
That's right. Dune Part 2 is the second in the series of movies directed and co-written by Denis Villeneuve.
Is how you pronounce his name.
Well, that's true. Yeah. And but I will say this. He is the greatest director in modern times because he's a Quebecer. Anyway, also it was written by John Spatz, who did Prometheus and various others. The movie is a direct follow-up to Dune, which is just called Dune, but most people call it Dune Part 1, which was one of the big movies that was released to VOD streaming during the COVID. The two films together are based on the novel Dune by Frank Herbert. And the film stars a number of folk of note, pretty good cast of characters or actors, I should say, some A-listers and a lot of good character actors, including Timothy Chalamet, who is half French, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, who's Swedish, Josh Brolin, Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, who's British, Dave Bautista, Christopher Walken, Leigh Seydoux, who is French, and Stellan Skarsgård, as well as the great Charlotte Rampling, Javier Bardem, and Sohila Yacoub. The film also has Greg Fraser as cinematographer, Joe Walker as editor, and, of course, the great Hans Zimmer on music. The film was released by Warner Brothers, Legendary Pictures, and such. Came out on March 1st, 2024, everywhere. At least in the United States, I should say. It's a long film, 1 hour and 65 minutes. Budget of $190 million, and worldwide gross at the moment is at $384.1 million USD. Film is getting marvelous reviews by both critics and audiences alike. For example, it is at Rotten Tomatoes at 93% at 388 critics. And, of course, if one wanted to note the audience score, and I'm bringing that up now because I did not prepare, is, here we go.
I think it's even
95.
Higher. Yeah.
So it's pretty rock solid. It's a little more than the critics, but they're right equal. We'll discuss if that is true for any of us or we disagree. But that's all I got for in front of the camera and behind the camera. And so I guess we can get into our thoughts on the film and how we heard about it. So let's start with you, Mike.
I saw it because it's Dune. I heard about it because it's Dune. It's got a stellar cast and a huge marketing budget. They made a first one. They called it Part 1. That tended to imply a Part 2. So that's really how I found out about it and why I watched it. Pam and I saw it on a Wednesday night. We wanted to see it in IMAX. I wanted to see it in IMAX. I didn't really ask her, but she usually prefers seeing it in IMAX. And we were both busy. Wednesday night was the only time we could go. We caught a late show. It was still kind of crowded, not completely crowded. It wasn't nuts, but it had still had a good crowd. I liked it a lot. I'm not going to lie. There are things I could quibble about it. They're minor quibbles, and a lot of them are either just aesthetic choices or things that logistically there was probably no way to do it without A, having completely changed how the series was shot, or B, adding like an extra 30 minutes to an hour to an already 2-hour and 45-minute film. I think the cast is fantastic. The cinematography is fantastic. I think the amazing thing is that, if I recall correctly, the budget was quote unquote only $150 million. So I don't know how he managed to keep the budget down, but it is would imply that they have that a lot of these films that have like $200-300 million budgets may be grossly overinflated.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think a lot of us have said for a while.
Yeah.
Anything else? Conclusion of your thoughts?
Yeah, that was my conclusion of my thoughts. Anything else? Detail.
right. Fair enough.
Please stop speaking.
Fair enough. Usually you go a little, on a little longer, so we thought we'd...
Yeah, I think we're all waiting.
Well, I know that we're on a timer here because we started late and somebody's going to pull the ripcord in an hour and 42 minutes.
Right, fair enough. All right, let's go with you, Eric.
Yeah, I love this. The same thing as Mike, it's been well marketed, and I saw part one. I was unable to attend the recording session for part one, but I did really enjoy part one. And I enjoyed part two even more, I think. I don't have any real quibbles. I have read the book, but it was over 35 years ago. It's been a long, long time since I read the book.
Ooh, you're old.
Yeah, I'm old. I was an adolescent when I read the book. Yeah, but I really enjoyed this. I think... Denis Villeneuve, in my opinion, might be the best sci-fi director. Yeah, just period. It could be argued, but that's my opinion today. Because every single movie I've seen that he's made just looks absolutely amazing. And I also think Arrival is one of the best sci-fi movies ever made. But yeah, I love this. There are a whole bunch of details I love that we'll get into later. But yeah, all in all, thumbs up for me.
All right, well, would you say the Arrival is Lovecraftian?
Not really. It just has squid aliens.
Exactly, a squid monster.
I've not seen it. Don't talk about it. Oh my god.
Well, no, but I wouldn't call it.
It has squid monsters. That's the only reason why.
Yeah. You should watch it, Barrett. It's a good movie.
I know. I've been told not just by you guys, but another friend of mine is like, "You have not seen that film. You must die."
Is he overdubbed from Japanese?
I think he is, actually, which would make it even...
That is hyperbole. Missing it isn't the end of the world, but it is a good film.
Yeah. Oh, I know it's hyperbole. It's hyperbole for him, too, but, you know.
Right. All right, so let's go on to me. I heard about this film because, yeah, the same way Mike did, that, you know, if the first one was considered a non-failure, they were going to make a second, which they did. So I saw it, I think it was Saturday night, just a couple of nights ago. That would have been on the 9th of March. And I saw it not on IMAX. I had sparing time to and days that I could actually get to see it. So I just went to a quick showing that I could get to without disturbing the time with the family and whatnot. So my opinion on the film, I'm kind of with Eric. This was a lot better than even the first one. This is a masterpiece in many ways. There's a lot of praise that for everybody in the film. That's why I read who scored the film, who was the cinematographer, who was the editor, among listing all the actors and the screenwriters and so forth, because there's a lot of good in it. There's some interesting things I'm going to throw out as devil's advocate when we talk about the film, and it's not because the film is bad, just some curiosities. But all in all, a high praise for the film and a big thumbs up. Let's go with you, Barrett.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have not heard about this film because I'm a huge Dune fan, and of course, I saw the first one of these two. I was a little let down with the first one, not from a technical perspective, but more of a from the book perspective. I liked this one a lot more. I do think this second one is a masterpiece. You might as well include the first one with it. But while they are a masterpiece, if it was not adapted from the book, it would be really, really high in my estimations. But there's some choices they made in the film that I did not think served the story very well. But we can get into that later. But visually and everything else, this movie is amazing. And it's close enough to the book that I'm pretty pleased.
All right, sounds good. All right, so that's our reviews of the film. And with that, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. Paul Atreides unites with Chani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family.
All right. That means nothing if you didn't see the first film or know anything about the book. So that's good. I like it. You don't want to know anything. Just go in. So what do we do here on the Dark Discussions podcast? Well, basically we do a review, which we generally just did. But we do more than reviews here on the Dark Discussions podcast for all our new listeners or those who are regulars. What we do is we talk about everything and anything related to the film. So there's two parts. The first part is much shorter, but it is the non-spoiler section. So we talk about general things. So we may talk about, for example, Frank Herbert and his writing. We may talk about these films 1 and 2 compared to the sci-fi miniseries and the original David Lynch film. We may talk about some of the differences, as Barrett mentioned, from the book. And we'll talk about general stuff. But then we will throw up a spoiler alert. And at that point, we will talk about everything and anything related to the film. So we will talk about spoilers, twists, the ending, the meaning behind the story and its interpretation by those who made the film. So, again, we will talk about everything and anything. But before we do that, we talk about the generic stuff, the non-spoiler stuff. And so we're in that section now. And to start, I think the main thing that makes this film so much better than the first, and again, I like what Barrett said, the first was well made just like this one. But as a story, this one is so much better, and I think that's because the first one, unfortunately, had a lot of the wax on, wax off stuff as Paul Atreides learns skills and finds out who he is and all that. So it's basically the origin story. Origin stories can get fairly, in my opinion, I don't want to say boring, but non-rewatchable. Watch them once, and it's hard to go back to rewatch them again, I feel, because it's like, okay, whatever. But this one here doesn't have that because it's basically right into the story, I feel. Go ahead, Mark.
And I hear what you're saying, but the part one really had a thankless task, which is they had to set everything up for part two. So you had to go through all that. They had to set up this world for you because it is science fiction. It is an alien world. You don't understand the rules, and you need to understand the rules. So they had to do all that in part one. So I get what you're saying, but I think part one served its purpose.
Well, and that's kind of why I said it doesn't stand alone, the first one. If it stands with this film, it's is good. You know what I mean? Like, it's one long film to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're underselling the challenge. It wasn't just that they had to set up Dune 2. They had to set up Dune 2 without even knowing if there was going to be a Dune 2. So that's just sort of like, putting out a, we're gonna end the movie. We're going to give you an IOU that we don't know if we're ever going to be able to collect on.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some things that we, I don't know if we want to talk about it now or later, that I think hurt because they didn't greenlight both films. And so they had to shuffle some characters around, I think, and not put them in the first film when they could have. And just, I guess, maybe for a budget thing or just because they wouldn't have had much to do. And part of me would like to see some re-editing of the two movies into one just cohesive whole.
Agreed.
And I think, and I have no idea how many deleted scenes there are. And I don't just mean just take part one, slap it onto part two, because I think there's some things that they could do otherwise. But it's, I think it's our complaint. It really was just, I think, how the first one ended with that first one. I think it just ended in a weird spot.
But they had to stop somewhere.
I'm rewatching it. I think there was an earlier spot they could have ended, but then that would have added about 20 minutes to this movie.
Right. Which is over 3 hours, which is insane.
Oh, this is weird. And now, like Phil, I'm not necessarily a big fan of watching teenage boys wax on and wax off. but I actually tend to like origin stories. And I think there's a lot of that still here, though, right? And that the first hour of the film or so is just getting him to ride the sandworm and him mm-hmm. learning the culture, and that's still part of it. But they speed run through it without doing a montage set to music by Tangerine Dream, right? They're just running through. And, like, you don't see him training to ride a sandworm. He kind of asks, hey, you think I could
what
ride
do
a sandworm?
What do I have to do?
And they're like, yeah, fat chance. You'll die. And then, like, 2 seconds later, he said, all right, go ride the fucking sandworm. I'm like, what? So there was a little bit of, and again, this is a 2-hour and 45-minute movie. There were times I felt like, it was going on fast forward. Someone said that there was, a lot of the Game of Thrones season 8 travel stuff going on where they just like skipped over all the,
right.
The dull parts. And that, just to be clear, that's not really a criticism. It's a story structure thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it works because you know what the alternative was? Adding another hour to the film.
Of them walking in the desert. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're walking. Yeah. That's, I'm glad they didn't do that. I didn't need to see them going, okay, now this is the hook that you use and you throw it onto the sandworm. And if you pull like this, he turns right. You pull like that, he turns left. I didn't need to see any of that.
Right. Well, and here's,
so I'm glad I'm not, I know I'm sound like I'm jabbing it, and I am a little bit, but I think it was a smart creative choice, and it's very well done the way they did it.
Well, without going into the story elements, I want to say a couple things about the film, which is that, first of all, this might be some of the best world building I've ever seen, because I totally buy it. It's like you're in this place. You buy this culture. It's pretty cool. And like the whole thing is just like there are flying machines in this movie that have wings like a dragonfly made of metal. Now, there's a reason that airplanes aren't designed like that, because it wouldn't work. But watching this movie, I'm not thinking that wouldn't work. I'm thinking, whoa, cool.
my understanding is that's actually how helicopters got started.
Maybe. And the other thing that I really enjoyed about this movie was the fighting style of the Fremen. I didn't have a chance to do any research, so I'm very curious to see if there were any particular martial arts that they were inspired by in order to create all of that. But I really loved how, while they are in the middle of a firefight, they're also running and flipping and rolling and doing all that stuff. It was almost like the Cirque du Soleil on attack. So I really enjoyed that aspect of the movie. So I just wanted to throw those two things out there.
Right. Yeah, I have to say the story is an interesting story for me, because obviously, we had writers like Edgar Rice Burroughs and Jack Williamson and folks like that wrote a lot of space opera stuff. And then at a certain point, we had the hard science fiction, which was Isaac Ivanov, Robert Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, John Campbell, and things like that. And then Herbert's book kind of came out around the same time as all the hard science fiction authors. And I had read a bunch of those hard science fiction authors. And so I said, I hadn't read any Herbert. And so I picked up Dune, because obviously that was his big one in the classic. And I was kind of surprised that it wasn't hard science fiction. It was more like Burroughs and Jack Williamson, and it felt like an anomaly for its time, when the time had people like Philip K. Dick and stuff. All those guys were in the 50s and 60s, and his story was kind of different because it's not really hard science fiction. It's kind of like a Star Wars-y space opera stuff. And I thought it was just an odd book when I read it. And it is kind of odd when I compare it to all his contemporaries. But
I mean, what when you say hard science fiction, what do you mean? I want to know what you mean by that. Like,
hard science fiction, science fiction
shows things that aren't real now.
Science fiction would be visual example would be 2001: A Space Odyssey, which is Arthur C. Clarke.
But I mean, like books themselves, because
that's Arthur C. Clarke. He wrote that
Rendezvous with Rama.
I
believe the distinction that Phil is making is something based in
iRobot,
our reality versus a fantasy world.
Right, exactly.
Right. Well,
and I'm not sure that I completely agree, because that line is has been soft forever. I mean,
hard science fiction is traditionally defined as stuff that is accepted as scientifically possible, and soft science fiction. And so something like War of the Worlds, admittedly, we now know that there are no creatures living underneath the surface of Mars, but you rewind, but you know, to 19th century, that was considered hard science fiction.
Right. That to me is, and you still have alien creatures that we don't know exist, that there's no reality behind it. It's fantastic.
They could exist. Right. And that science says it's possible. Right. They didn't have submarines when 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was written, but they were possible. Right. And so what was science fiction is turned into some weird sort of science fact. In Dune, you have psychics, you have psychic abilities, so your ability to read minds.
Yeah, let's not get into that part. That's not what I was thinking of. I was thinking
that's
shields and things like that.
I was also talking about soft science fiction and space opera kind of thing.
Right, and people,
because you have force powers.
Right, exactly, and you have people who can live without getting germs like the Martians.
We don't need to rehash that argument. We've had it many times. I don't agree on that telepathy can't be considered science fiction.
No, I didn't say science fiction. I said hard science fiction.
Hard science fiction.
But when you say that, you kind of bring it towards fantasy, and I don't find it fantasy either. It's not. There's a huge difference.
Is that hard science?
One subgenre in science.
It's a
fiction.
Subgenre. Yeah, right. You have to read what the definition is of hard science fiction is, I guess. To
yeah, I just think there's very few authors that actually stick to hard science fiction. It's just not that common.
Right. It doesn't sell that
real.
Right.
Hard like a diamond or my boner.
But that I was just saying that compared.
I know you don't like every conversation, Eric, but this one, you know, is interesting to me. So I wanted to talk about it.
I feel it's interesting too. All I meant, Barrett, was that compared to his contemporaries, this story is much.
Yeah,
different.
I get it now.
That's all I meant. You know,
I'm just getting clarification. I wanted to understand. It's an interesting subject because genres change. So.
Yeah, most certainly, and especially science fiction. I mean, there's so many subgenres of science fiction, because you could even say World War of the Worlds is Earth-based, you know, where humans don't have technology yet, versus, say, you know, Arthur C. Clarke and his elevator to orbit, you know, that and stuff like that. So it's a wide range.
And that's why I wondered, because, like, I wonder, is Dan Simmons, like, hard sci-fi, or is he just sci-fi, or, you know, for his Endymion series or whatever. But anyway, I digress. Yeah. Thank you.
Fair question. That actually may be a pretty good episode for Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews, talking about science fiction and the subgenres, just, you know, in general, both in books and movies.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, it actually would be pretty cool. I think, Mike, you would be curious to join us for that one, maybe. Anyway, where do we want to go from here? Since, Eric, you seem to want to move on. Did you have something that you wanted to bring up that was generic before we get into the spoiler territory?
No, I was just trying to talk to them about the movie, and you guys keep on talking about the book.
Well, I think that this applies to both.
Yeah, I think it does.
One of the general things I wanted to bring up was how cool the Harkonnen area was. I just love that black and white feel.
It felt very like Halo, the military base that I always joke about how it's just stagnant or dull, but here it's more, I don't know how to put it to words, but I know exactly what you're trying to say, Barrett. Maybe you have better words or terminology for
what. Well, it seemed like they were living under a different type of sun, and so it had a different look and feel.
It's a black sun.
Yeah, which was kind of wild.
And that's one of those things that I felt conflicted because I don't think there's any kind of light that just causes things to turn black and white. It was a neat visual effect, but it was a weird visual effect because it was literally black and white, not just, you know, like sun bleached or like, remember when we saw the like pitch black, right? Had a very distinct look in the color. And so again, this is getting there. So there's a little part of me is going, really? It's a tiny part, but I also appreciated the aesthetics of it.
It felt like a World War II reel.
Well, it was,
and that's the thing they did to the Harkonnens.
I felt it fit in well to how they did. I mean, I can see how it could be take someone out for a second, but when they would go back into the building, it was all color again, and then when they got bleached out by the sun, it was black and white, and it was kind of interesting aesthetic, especially since we've seen stuff like you said, Mike, a pitch black. Here, they decided to go a different route, which has turned it into monochrome in a sense. So I thought thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, one of the I like the psychosis of the Harkonnens.
Yes.
Those guys are not stable.
And that's one of the things, piss off Eric, that I know they changed from the book because they make Baron Harkonnen a homosexual pedophile. And here he's just kind of a pure hedonist. And they remove a lot of that stuff with it, but I really wish we had spent more time with them. That's one of my issues. But I also know it's not like the Baron is going to be the villain over the entire course of the series. You know, his journey ends here. Fade doesn't.
But you know what, Mike? In the book, and sorry again, Eric, but in the book, his character has a large presence in many pages in the book. So. Because, you know, even though this is a whole universe that Herbert created, the Dune book, you know, you could read that as a standalone book, right? And none of the other books could have
that. Absolutely. Even,
yeah.
And this one has the advantage of knowing it's not technically probably not a standalone, or that it's that they're hoping it to be more.
And he has a big presence, Phil, but I don't think he actually has a lot of scenes in the book. He has some, like in this movie. But I don't think he has a huge amount of scenes. It's just you feel his presence everywhere in the book.
Yeah, that could be fair, Barrett. Yeah, you've read the book more recently than I have. So I read it like 8 years ago.
I haven't read it.
There is something that I want to talk about in relation to the book, but I want to wait till we're past the spoiler flag because it's directly related to the plot.
Yeah, same for all of mine.
So one of the things I thought, first of all, Austin Butler I think is great as Fade.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, really good.
I was very impressed.
I will say, now, Austin Butler, previous to this, was best known for playing Elvis.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Part of me wants to see that Saturday Night Live skit where, like, he comes out playing Fade and, like, Villeneuve is going, no, we hired you for your Elvis. That was my vision for Fade.
I had heard that he had a hard time getting rid of that Elvis accent.
It might be. I didn't care for the teeth. The teeth just, the whole black mouth thing just weirded me out enough. I don't know why. Yeah, I mean it was supposed to. I just didn't like it. It didn't work for me in the way I think they maybe wanted it to. Even if it was the effect they wanted. Just the black teeth.
Oh yeah.
But put that aside. He's supposed to be the anti-Paul, and so I kind of wish. And I think they do in the book. I kind of wish that they had introduced him in the first film.
Oh, yeah.
And probably for contractual reasons, they couldn't because then they would have had to pay him. I could very easily have seen something like, you know, just mentioning him when they're right after Paul undergoes the Gamja Bar test, you know, sort of the Yoda, there is another, you know. and we could have gone to the Harkonnens and just had little bits more of him interspersed. So that way, for me, it would have felt more epic when they finally came together. Because as it is, you don't really get to the Harkonnens until about an hour into the movie this time. And seeing, in terms of seeing the Harkonnens homeworld and meeting Fade and all that, it takes a while to get there because they're doing a lot of work with Paul and getting him settled in with the Fremen. And that's a very minor gripe. Because I still think he works really well. I think the final fight, without spoiling it, goes really well. I don't know that they did a lot with Raban. But again, if you want to flesh that out, you're going to make it a 4-hour film. And I don't want that either. In the grand scheme of things, this is not a story about the Harkonnens. Well, except...
Well, Raban...
Not those three, anyway.
Raban had, I think, more of a presence in the first film, right? And then as he became, fell out of favor and he showed that he was incompetent, the second film pretty much, he became a very much secondary character, for sure. I'll keep that for after the spoiler stuff. Where else do we want to go? Non-spoilery stuff that we want to bring up. Let me ask you this, because me and Barrett were talking about this offline. I said to him that they had this Florence Pugh, and I'm hoping I'm saying her name correctly.
Who's a great?
What's that?
That's how you say it.
Oh, excellent. Great. She's a great actress, Academy Award nominated actress, one of the bigger actresses at the moment. And she had this secondary role as Princess Irulan. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was for contractual. It was cheaper to hire her that way or something. But I felt they could have used her instead as Chani, I felt, and I'm not sure why they decided to go with Zendaya, who's a fine actress. I mean, I've watched her on Euphoria and in the Spider-Man movies, but for whatever reason, I felt she was the weakest link, if not bad, because she was not. She was fine, but when you have someone of Florence Pugh's abilities and presence, it would have been wiser, I think, to have her in a bigger role. And I'm just thinking of the Chani role as possibly her role, but I
think ethnicity is a part of it. I think that they got Florence Pugh, and there's a reason she doesn't show up in the first film. They're probably with a promise that she's going to have a bigger role in the second. And that would be my guess.
Well, ethnicity
a bigger role in the third. And Zendaya is very, very popular with young girls. And if you think about the demographic for Dune, that's not it. So right. If you want to get young girls to come to the movie, cast actors who are popular with young girls, and they did that, right? They cast the two leads, nominal leads. Timothée Chalamet, who my niece has pictures of all over their refrigerator, and Zendaya.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to do it, and I think she works fine in the part. I agree, she's not the strongest part, but I think she does well what she's supposed to do, and I think that Florence Pugh is fine. And curse you, Eric, for failing to give us a chance to gaslight Phil on how to pronounce her name.
I did pronounce it correctly. So
you did. I'm just saying.
My issue is not with Zendaya. It's with the scripting for her part. I don't think it was right. Other than that, I think it's the biggest flaw in the movie.
Also, the ethnicity. I don't. If I'm not mistaken, Barrett, you'd be more familiar with this than me, because again, I read the book about 8 years ago. I don't think they really talk about the ethnicities of the Fremen, meaning what they would be compared to, say, people in the real world.
I don't think it matters because it's 20,000 years or whatever in the future. Right. So,
yeah. In reality, I mean, this is 8,000 years in the future. if you go back 8,000 years, you're talking early days of ancient Egypt, maybe even before that. Things would have been, would be completely different. But obviously, they're going for a specific look. Like, so...
Yeah, maybe that's what...
Well, they're going with our current world archetypes, I feel like.
Right, and I think that's what they're doing. So I just think that that they were looking at someone who is more ethnic for what representing the Fremen, and I think that was an artistic choice, not a we're trying to match the book kind of choice.
That's what I felt too.
Yeah,
I guess.
Right, yeah. I kind of like what they did with their character, but we'll talk about that. That later.
I like some of it, and I don't like other pieces of it. So yeah, we'll talk about that much further because I think, like I said, I think that's the biggest flaw of this movie.
Right. Yeah, and again, I liked her. I just felt like when you rolled perfectly too, I felt. But either way, that's just a thing.
But Pugh's going to have a big part. So and they also cast Anna Taylor Joy in a cameo.
Yeah,
with plans on using her in a bigger part later on.
That was a nice surprise.
It was interesting.
But by the way, that's also you could do the same thing with the first book or chapter one of Dune. Or part one of Dune, whatever they called it. Because Zendaya was barely in that. She just shows up at the end, has a couple of scenes. And you say, why did they cast her in that for just a couple of scenes when they could have cast somebody else? And so I think they're just seating these actors in and they're getting them under contract while they can and saying, look, we're going to give you a little piece. We're going to give the audience a taste. And then you're going to have a big part in the next movie. And I think that's what they did with those, each of the three actresses.
So, which three actresses were there again? Because I got cut.
Zendaya, Florence Pugh, and Anya Taylor-Joy.
Gotcha. Yep. Fair enough.
I'm really curious to see where this is going to go as far as the franchise, for lack of a better word. Because I looked at the Wikipedia for the novel because it's been so long since I read it. Just to see if that's where the book ends, and it is. So are they going to be just like, okay, that's Dune, or are they going to try and go forward with it? And if they go forward with it, like I don't think you can go forward with it without the same cast and director.
They're working on Dune Messiah, supposedly.
Yeah, that's what I read.
And if you get, I think you have to have this cast to get the Children of Dune. But when you get past that, it gets really weird and bizarro. So I don't even know how they'll film that. So I think it's going to end at Children of Dune, just like the sci-fi miniseries did.
Villeneuve's basically said he's going to do the next one and then he's out. But the way things work in Hollywood,
yeah,
you know, like Spielberg hasn't directed a Jurassic Park movie. Since Lost World, but his name is still there as executive producer. So Villeneuve is going to be...
Well, and they suck now, so...
Yeah, but that's a whole other issue.
Once you get your name on the first one, you're on all of them.
And that's why the executive producer lists just never end.
Continue. That's fine.
So he'll probably have a hand in it. He's just not going to be the one directing it. I'm sure.
Well, they're also supposed to have a TV spinoff too, something called Dune Prophecy, which completely different characters.
And then there's the Nickelodeon Fremen babies that they're doing. So that's
well. And honestly, I mean, the first three books, it would be four movies, are very interconnected. But then you go thousands of years forward once you get to the fourth book. So
it'll be like Game of Thrones and the new series, House of the Dragon or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Where it's different. It's the same world, but different characters, right?
Yeah.
So the first three books is Paul Atreides' story, I guess, right? And then
him and his children. Yeah,
right. And then after that, it's completely different stuff.
Yep. Gotcha. There's only one constant character through all the books that Frank Herbert wrote.
Which one's that? Which character?
Duncan. He is in all of the books that Frank Herbert wrote.
Gotcha. You mean all of them or just those three?
All of them. The ones that Frank Herbert wrote, he is in all of them.
Gotcha.
you haven't read it, I don't want to give away a story plot item.
Right, right. And Duncan, who played Duncan again in the film?
Jason Momoa.
Oh,
I think.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He was already dead. Yeah. He died in the.
Yeah, he died, but he's in all of them.
That's right. Even book two and three, Messiah and Children of.
Yeah. Dune, yeah.
Even though he's dead.
Yep.
Does he come back as like an Obi-Wan Kenobi or something?
They can
read
make
the book.
Yeah, read the book. Yeah.
Well, you can tell me offline. I'll text you.
Yeah, I'll tell you offline.
He's a vampire.
Right. Or he suddenly has cravings for brains. Something. A zombie or something. Anyway, what else do we want to talk about that's non-spoiler?
There are things that I think people will be thrown by if they know the book or know the Lynch movie. I was actually surprised to me how little the spice seemed to factor into it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very true.
No guild navigators. I also thought, no mentats, right, and, really.
And I understand that what the mentats disappeared. The poor mentats just, I don't know, like if they dropped
no spice farms,
Yeah, I don't know if they dropped a bad word on TikTok or something, but the mentats
they're kind of critical. I mean, they're one of the four powers, right? You have the noble houses, you have Bene Gesserit, then you have the mentats and the guild navigators, and they all have a piece of power.
Right, and I actually just had started rereading Dune. I was hoping to get through it before we did the podcast, and I've just gotten into work hell for the last week and a half, so I wasn't able to do it. But there is a moment early in the book where they talk about Paul maybe being a mentat, right? And again, I've read the book in 40 years, so even that aspect of the character is dropped. The voice makes has almost very little to do with the rest of the movie. There's only two or three moments of the use of the voice in the second film. Where I'm thinking, like, if I'm fucking and fighting in the desert, I might just, like, throw out a drop dead and die moment, you know, just use the voice on some of these people. or go to use – it's like, that's a handy power to have. That's like Darth Vader refusing to use the Force choke.
Right.
So there are things that they downplay. Like, I understand, like, the people really want to see the navigators and what the navigators would look like and how that would go. But there is no – well, that's not true. There was almost no travel between worlds in these two films outside of the Atreides family coming to Dune, right? We don't really see that, so I can understand them not feeling the need.
But they need the navigators for any type of travel, and they have a huge influence on the Emperor and what the Emperor
does.
They
don't have a need for any type of travel because they just they do sand walking through the desert. They don't need a navigator.
No, interstellar
right,
travel.
But my point is they're not doing any interstellar travel.
And Barrett,
not, the whole fleet comes there, and they have to pay money to the guild to get there.
But we're not in their point of view. We're in Paul's point of view for most of the film. Right? We're not following characters traveling through space.
Barrett, do they have a big role? Did they have a big role in Messiah or Children of Dune?
Yeah, they're part of the factions that are all trying to not have Paul as as an emperor or in charge. They're one of the reasons that they try to kill him early on. They don't want him alive.
Right.
Because they also can see the future too.
Right.
They're prescient.
And it's funny because I also think that with Dune as it is, this is an accessible version of Dune. I'm pretty sure there was a choice they made because it might have been too weird and freaky if they hadn't. And then what happens when you start introducing the guild navigators and the mutations that have befallen them.
If they never have the guilds in this, like if they come out with the next movie and there's no guild.
No, but I just think they didn't have a place here. I think they're coming. I just don't think they needed to squeeze them in this.
I don't know.
If you're allocating the money, like what do we really need to put in this film and what can we cut to save to be frugal and to keep the story streamlined, I understand why they would cut out the navigators.
Yeah, not me, but that's me. I don't have to agree.
That's okay. You can be wrong.
And you can be wrong, too.
Well, I don't.
But weirdly enough, that hasn't happened. So anyway.
Both can be totally annoying.
I don't think
that's the main goal. How's the best way to piss Eric off?
There you go. I think you guys were just making two observations, two points of view, and there wasn't anything to really.
No, I wouldn't have had a problem if they put it in there, but I can understand why they made that choice.
Right.
And I suspect, and they have to, like, they're too important for the, from what I understand, because all I ever read was the first one. But they're too important for my understanding of the whole story arc that they can just, like, ignore them.
I would have said that about the first book, so maybe not.
I don't know.
All right. Now, this is one thing I noticed, and I mentioned it to Barrett, and I'm just curious your thoughts. Well, first of all, Zimmer, obviously, he won an Academy Award for the first movie and its music. And here, it's pretty powerful stuff, too. It's kind of an interesting score because it's kind of rock and roll rather than just classical-sounding music that, say, John Williams would do.
You got, like, some throat singers in there on
He's got guitars playing, you know, which is kind of interesting and so on. But the thing that when you played those type of music, those rock musics and whatever, a lot of it was during a lot of war and violent scenes and stuff. And I was thinking about it, and again, this could just be me being devil's advocate, but it felt to me a little bit, and I'm not poo-pooing the film because I felt that way. It was just an observation, which is the movie felt as if it was glorifying war and showing war as something that was pretty strong. So in other words, it kind of reminded me of Leffe Raffenstahl's Nazi movies where it's trying to pump up people to like go. It's an interesting thought, I felt. And then obviously they threw Zendaya's character Chani in there to walk away, but I don't know if she was walking, what reason she was walking away, whether it was because she was just jealous or who knows, but at least that was a opposite point of view.
We can talk about that more post-spoiler.
Okay. Oh, all right. So you feel that there's more to say, but after we throw the spoiler, fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up that is non-spoilerly? All right, so I guess we can throw up the spoiler alert. So at this point, we do in this podcast talk about everything and anything related to the film. So spoilers and the ending and twists and all that good stuff. So since I just brought that up and we just went into
no, spoilers, we can absolutely continue with that train of thought.
Yeah, so let's do that.
So I see where you're coming from with that, Phil. But everybody in this movie has motivation. It's not just war for the sake of war. It's war for the sake of power, which, although your mileage may vary as far as the validity of that, but it is a reason that war happens. So it's all about the spice, right? And for the Fremen, it's about regaining control of their planet. So there was a lot of fighting in this movie, and there was a lot of war in this movie, but it was all motivated.
But I guess the portrayal of it by the director made it feel like it was good. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, because, you know, it's a movie, it's entertainment, it's whatever.
I don't know, man. There was that one scene where the two armies are charging each other across the desert.
Yep.
And man, I know people have been doing that for hundreds of years. I don't know if I could do that. I'd just be like, no, man, I'm out. I'm not gonna go run towards those angry people with weapons.
Yeah, it was weird too. I was wondering where the hell the Gatling guns were, so you just mow everybody down instead of this hand-to-hand combat.
Well, they have a problem with shields. They blow up in a nuclear explosion if lasers hit it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
that's true. The shields were really weirdly inconsistent.
True. Like,
sometimes they were using them, sometimes they weren't. Sometimes
in the movie, yes. In the movie, it was
in the movie, right? That's what I'm talking about.
So I just want to make sure.
No, so yeah. You see the Fremen using these powerful lasers to cut down the harvesters. And it's like, well, they don't have shields for the vehicles. They only have, I mean, they never established in the film. They don't establish, let's say, that shields are new technology that you can only make so big, and so you can't protect a giant ship, and therefore those might be vulnerable to lasers. So I don't know that they had spell everything out for us, but when you introduce the idea of shield early on, with people walking around with these personal shields, and then half the soldiers don't seem to have them, and sometimes the ships do, and sometimes the ships don't. It's confusing.
The reason bullets don't work is because it has to go through slow. Can't go through fast.
It has to go slow, which is like, right. Yeah. And they do that even when I was 13, I think, when the first Dune, the Lynch Dune came out, because I saw that before the book. I just got from that, that's the slow blade goes through the shields, and therefore things that are going fast won't. I picked up on that, and that's why they don't use guns, right? That made sense to me in a weird way, because they explained it well. And I think they did the same thing here. But then shields gets kind of disappear for large chunks of the film, and sometimes it was there. Sometimes it was apparent. I don't know why. Phil, I think as far as glorification of war, I think they are and they aren't, because, you have just war theory, whether you buy it or not. You know, the idea that there is time when war is appropriate, and here is a people that I think it's fair to say have been oppressed. The Harkonnens are literally, you know, black and white villains. There is. If there was one thing that made me roll my eyes in this film, it was the number of times that Harkonnen got angry and murdered one of his subordinates.
Yeah, one of his concubines. I think he kept on killing the concubines too.
Especially the one at the beginning where he just slammed the dude's head against the console like 5 million times. That was awesome.
It was awesome.
Yeah. Okay.
You run out of lackeys though after a while.
Well, that's why I had a problem with all of them doing it.
But that was the thing I meant, Mike, is how they portrayed it, not the motivations and whatnot. In other words, you know, playing the rock and roll music to the violence.
So you wanted the battle scenes to be uninteresting?
Well, I think they made an executive decision to try to make us like Paul, and it kind of reminded me of that documentary show, The Wave, where you know the professor turns all his students into Nazis without them knowing they're Nazis, and because they're proud of something.
I totally disagree with you, because I think that from everything that Villeneuve has said, he was trying to make Paul an anti-hero, so he doesn't necessarily want us to like him.
The Messiah
complex is what he's pushing for, is how a Messiah person is bad.
Well, I would concur with you, because I felt when you were talking about how they were turning him into an anti-hero, this movie made me feel that he was becoming an anti-hero. You're right.
Well, I want to jump in here with a couple of thoughts. I did feel like, I'm sure that Villeneuve did say that, but from watching the movie, what I was doing, like, I was rooting for Paul. I was on his side for most of the movie. And then at the end of the movie, I'm like, oh, shit. Did I bet on the wrong horse?
Right. Yeah, because he wanted to free, it seemed like, all right, he wanted to avenge his family, obviously, and he wanted to become the Duke like he was supposed to be. And he also had the Freeman who he was going to liberate. But then, like you said, Eric, at the very end, he says, I'm going to become the Emperor. And it's like, hold on, where did that come from?
The problem is they don't talk about the golden path at all. His purpose is to save humanity. And the only way he sees to do that is by him becoming Emperor and then lots of bad shit happening.
Well, and he tried to warn him, to be fair.
Yeah.
He was like, if we go south, some bad shit's going to happen.
Right, because
he fights it for as long as he can, and then he's forced to make a decision that he knows is not the decision he wants to make, but it's the only decision he can make if humanity itself is going to survive.
And you also mentioned something in passing that I wanted to touch on, because this is what I was specifically going to ask you about this, Barrett, since you've probably read the book more recently than any of the rest of us. I reading the book as a teenager, I did not pick up on this at all. And I'm wondering if it was there and I just didn't understand enough about the world yet to pick up on it. But in the movie, I was definitely picking up some anti-religion messaging. it's like, you know, Messiah is how they control you. They tell you when coming and then you wait around for a couple of years. It's how you control people. Is that from the book? I don't remember it.
So, and that's to me the whole anti-hero idea. I mean, I don't know if it's anti-religion, but the Bene Gesserit use religion as a way of controlling people, and they put all these different myths on different planets for over hundreds and thousands of years so that, when they crash there or are stuck there or whatever, they have power.
That's one of the arguments, is that religion is a way of controlling people. And
right.
I think that's why it's an anti-religion thing. Now, that obviously isn't going to fly for people who necessarily believe that their religion is the real religion, and therefore it's not a way of necessarily controlling them. But I think
are religious too, Mike. Not all religions are violent, right? And so a lot of people –
No, but this isn't just about violent religion. This is about using religion as control, right? And that's what she's – and that's one of the things that the Zendaya says, right, is that the judge says, is that by promising a Messiah, it's basically a way to get us to sit around in our ass and wait for somebody to come instead of actually taking action.
And that is the whole purpose. The Bene Gesserit want a safe haven wherever they go.
Yeah, Charlotte Rampling's character says that specifically at the end.
But I'm not sure that Frank Herbert is necessarily anti-religion. I think he's just writing a story in that regard. I do think he might be homophobic. I've read stuff about that. His gay son. And that's why the Baron is the way he is.
Well, also, in the book, you know, they talk about jihad. And you can argue that if he took the presentation of the real world as the presentation of his false, you know, his fantasy world, you could argue that he was implying the freemen were Muslim hoods too, right? I mean, that's
yeah. I think that is what he's referring to. Yeah,
I think what he's doing is he's trying to get. Look, we have tropes that we have lived with in stories for a very long time, and obviously in films. And one of the tropes is the Messiah trope, right? The chosen one come along. We're all conditioned. Oh, this is the chosen one. This is the one we're supposed to root for because they're the hero. Here's the bad guys.
Right, but in religion, the Messiah can mean someone peaceful like Jesus Christ.
Yeah, but that's not what they're doing here. But the point is that he's putting you on the side. And let's be honest, we tune in because we want to see Paul kick some ass, right? There's the scene in the film where she says your father, you know, didn't believe in revenge. He said, "Well, I do."
In the book.
And you know why? And we want to watch revenge. There is that bloodthirsty aspect to us. We want to watch the bad guys get punished. We don't want to watch Paul go clean.
But then they take the further step, Mike, which is, I want to be emperor. And that's.
Yeah, and I don't think he wanted to be in the book at all. I think that he knew what was going to happen, but eventually he had to become the emperor. And I think the whole idea as you get into Dune Messiah is that he knows that what he's done is being used for bad things, but there's no stopping it at this point, you know? He has lost control of the myth.
I saw – just watched it a second time last night. There's a moment in the film where he's very clear where he says he's seen the future. And if he does this step, he has one more step to take. And if he takes this step, it's going to mean war. And it's going to mean billions dying across the galaxy. He's telling you bad things will happen. And the audience is going, no, fuck him. Do it. Do it. Beat the bad guys. Beat the bad guys.
Yeah. Well, and that's glorifying war. In a sense.
Right, but what it's trying to do is set you up so that you're on his side, and at the end,
Right. It's like The Wave, that documentary movie that I mentioned earlier.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think that's what he's trying. I think that's what he's trying to do because, and from what Villanova said, right, is that in his eyes, like that Paul isn't a hero in a traditional sense, right? And that's, and everyone thinks in the first book he's a hero. It's fairly black and white, but the point, yep. But he has, unlike Herbert, I don't know what Herbert had planned, and how much he just ended up where he ended up. But let's pretend for a moment all Herbert had was Dune, and because that's how he wrote it. Dune was written, and Paul is the hero of that book, but then it becomes a very different thing. And he's got American audiences in 2024 rooting for jihadis, which is a weird thing. But because he's really presents a very clear black and white picture.
Right. Well, and also, though, Mike, to be fair,
guys. But, here's the
bad guys. But to be fair, this is a fictional world. And what it is you have these, like you said, black and white characters. So you have these black, meaning evil villains in the Harkonnen or whatever they're called. And the Emperor who intentionally set the whole process to happen. And so you have the Atreides folk. Even though they're, in a sense, kind of doing some dirty things, not necessarily intentionally, because, you know, she, the mother has to do her machinations to get things rolling and all that. But the point is that we as an audience want justice for him and his family and his people, just as we want justice for the freemen who have been suppressed and are being slaughtered by the Harkonnen. So if you take that as a real world thing, I see exactly what you're saying. But I can feel that the 2024 audience of Americans who are watching this aren't watching this as supporting jihad against good people. They're watching. They're watching folks fight against the evil Harkonnen and getting their justice. And then he pulls the rug under us when Paul says, kill them all, and I'm going
to
be emperor.
Because he's saying it's not as easy to stop as you think, and it's not, and the world isn't as black and white as you think. I think that's – and it, even if this one specific instance is very black and white, not every instance is going to be. And once you start down – and this is a path that once you start down, you may not stop. Right? Yeah. And Paul – and I'm pretty sure you haven't seen the films, Phil. And obviously, I know Dune came first.
But, I haven't seen what?
The Marvel Infinity War and Endgame.
Oh, where, I saw the last one, the one where they all died. Black Widow died. I forget what the name of that one is.
That was Endgame.
So,
yeah.
Okay, right. So I saw that one.
And before that, in Infinity War, Doctor Strange is looking through all the alternate realities and timelines using the Time Stone. He looks at 8 million possible futures, and there's only one in which they win. And so
that's kind of what Paul does in this movie.
And that's exactly what Paul is doing here. Paul is looking at all these possible futures, and all these possible futures, the Atreides and their people and the Fremen and their people end up on the shit end of the stick, but there's a few where they come out right. But some terrible fucking things have to happen in order for them to get to that happy ending. And it is very much, in his view, a ends justify the means. We want to get to the happy place at the end, 1,000 years in the future, but we're going to go through some awful stuff to it, and I'm going to cause some awful stuff to get there. And I think, and I don't think they do the greatest job of explaining all the mythology of Dune. I do wonder how
they
much
do not.
People who don't know Dune or have not done some advanced research, as I, because again, I never read past the first book, who did, they're going to come in there and be kind of confused on the nuance points. Now, I don't think you need to understand that to enjoy the film, because it is very much a standard on the surface trope of the chosen one rises up against the clearly bad guys. He beats the bad guys at the end. And now we're going to go for the next sequel that is a little ominous, but maybe we don't, that people aren't aware of just how bad this is going to go.
And that's why I say this film is a masterpiece, if a complete masterpiece, if I don't take into account the book, because I think it does change some motivations in how things appear.
And remove some of the characters.
I think that's how you should take it. Cause I mean, you're never going to get a movie that's just like the book. It's just not going to happen.
I totally accept that. Yeah. That's why I'm saying it's a masterpiece of film work. It's just, I have some issues with it that maybe a lot of other people wouldn't. A normal crowd that isn't as invested in the books wouldn't.
Barrett, I as I always do, I go back and read hundreds of reviews. Well, not hundreds. That's obviously hyperbole. But a good, 20 or so reviews after I see a film. And the interesting thing about this film, even though it has a 93% good reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, a lot of those reviews, most of them, believe it or not, are like 3 out of 5 stars or 3.5 out of 5 stars and things like that. So they don't call it a true masterpiece, but they noticed probably similar things that you notice. And just the bizarreness of the story. One reviewer, she mentioned how the story's fairly bizarre, even if it's a good movie, because you have a woman talking to a baby fetus and various things like that. It's just weird, and she points that out.
It's better than actually having the baby like in the David Lynch version, and I read a lot of stuff about how they didn't want to do that because it just would have been, they would have had to do time jump things in the film and they didn't want to have to do that, so there's a lot of reasons why they didn't have a toddler, intelligent toddler like in the David Lynch one.
For me, I felt that bothered me, not that they didn't have the talking toddler, but that everything that transpires felt like it should have taken longer than 7 months.
That I totally agree with. Yeah, that
and
is
so, like, when we're getting to the end of the movie, I'm like, this baby ain't born yet.
I know.
I'm like,
but do you think that's partly because you read the book?
We're looking at an adaptation here, and I think they did a great job of adapting the material so it's accessible for modern filmgoers.
I agree. And I said, I understand why they did it.
You're looking at already about 4+ hours of movie.
Yeah, right. I know. No, I can't imagine one without.
I would have been perfectly fine because to me, and this isn't about a matter of having seen Lynch or having read the book, watching it as a viewer, it felt to me that here's a guy who's gone from being the new guy on the block to being the messiah of the people, learning how to ride a sandworm, right? Learning how to survive in the desert. And he's done this all within a gestation period.
Well, you could count that up to he will know your ways. He will know your ways as if born to them.
Well, I know that.
Right. He's kind of like a superhero, Mike.
I get it. I'm just saying, but he also had to convince all these people within that time. It just felt to me like it was a little longer, and it felt like it was more time than just within that period. It's, like I said, it's a small thing.
Yeah.
We would be going at a 4-hour movie. Like I said, I said minor nitpicks, don't know how to fix them.
I didn't have a child.
I interfere, Mike, what you're saying, because they added a bunch of stuff, like the last hour of the film, which included the villain that he fights, the nephew of Harkonnen, the Baron, and all that stuff just had to be crunched in real quick at the second hour or the third hour of the film. And so I see your point. It's valid.
Well, like they didn't have Chani and him having a child, and that adds his first child's death. Adds a lot to his character, but I can see why they took that out. Just would have added time to it, and you don't need it. It doesn't have to happen in the movie.
Right, but it would have made the relationship feel more real than what it
was.
That
I agree with, yes.
Yeah, because it felt more of like high schoolers instead of real.
It really did. It was like a high school crush thing.
Yeah.
That was my biggest complaint with the movie is they made Chani seem really petulant And I did not like that part of it. In the books, she was much more supportive of him. And I think they could have had it both ways. She could have been very supportive of him, but still questioned him. Whereas this made her character seem almost very weaker pouty. To me.
Very pouty.
Yeah.
Oh, and I agree. That might be the way that the character was portrayed. That it came, or maybe just the way the actress performs, that she comes across as pouty.
That's possible.
I don't disagree with you there. I liked the fact that she was not a believer.
Yes, I did too.
And here's the reason why. Having been married for almost 25 years, if there's any one person in the world who's going to call you out on your messianic bullshit, it's going to be your wife.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if there was somebody who wasn't going to buy into it, because they see the man and not the Messiah, it made sense it would be her.
And that totally makes sense to me. I just don't think I would have had her, like, doing it in front of lots of people and some of the cinematic decisions they made.
Yeah, that
her,
was
especially
that was
walking weird. Out at the end.
Yeah, that was really weird. I felt she would have never done, based off the character that I know of her, she would have never done all that in front of everybody. It's because they never sat down to talk about it. She never said, let me talk about this with you before you do all this. And they didn't really have any of those conversations. Instead, she just pouts and walks out and gets angry. And it's like, but have the conversation. Say something.
Because he didn't have the conversation with her. And he just drops it on her that, and I'm going to marry the princess.
Well, right. I don't even mean that. I'm talking about all that earlier when Javier Bardem's character is already saying he's the Messiah, and she doesn't even sit with him then to talk about it. That's what part of the high schoolery thing about it. If they were quote unquote married and she had the kid with them that unfortunately didn't make it, then I don't know. So that
I think is the, and I thought that was, they established that there's a factionalism. There is a little racism, right? There's the, which, well.
Yeah, the Northerners and the Southerners.
Yeah, he's a Southerner, right? He's a redneck who believes in the Bible. And I'm a Northerner from Massachusetts. And I don't want to deal with that. And she just rejects, and she's been probably conditioned to reject being a Northerner, conditioned to reject the Messiah idea. Because we're not going to wait around for some Messiah to save us. I really liked the way they portrayed Javier Bardem, and I would love to see him once again get nominated for a Best Supporting Actor for this, because he's such a joy in this. He's the only thing resembling comedic relief in the film.
Yeah.
But I just but the way he delivers it is great. But and the way he's written is great. But little things like, well, what if I don't do it? Well, then clearly he's not the Messiah, and we just don't be in the desert, you know. So he's well aware that it's possible they're not the Messiah. He's just saying there's all these signs. I think you could be the Messiah. Well, what if we don't do that? Well, then you're not, and you just keep right. He doesn't have faith in him being the Messiah. He has faith that a Messiah will come, and that he might be the Messiah. And he has the conversation with the women, and it's basically
threatens to kill the mother, you know, do as right. I say, or well, we're gonna have to toss you into the desert, you know.
Right, toss you in the desert, but where he's like, I've seen the signs, and they're like, again, you know. So clearly, he's been through this before.
Right.
I wanted to say that one of the things I really enjoyed about this movie was Paul's visions. Because, like, out of any, we've seen visions in a bunch of movies, but, like, to me, for some reason, the way they did it in this movie seems the most real to me. Like, if somebody had visions, to me, that seems like it would, what it would be like, because it's not complete. It's not clear. You know, it's a glimpse, but not a vivid story, right?
Well, and I think in the story itself, he sees so many of them at once, it's hard to even pull out what you want to see. So mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think it's exactly how a vision
works. Well, and some of the visions are, like Mike said earlier, where this is one path, this is a different path, this is a different, you know, and on and on. So which one, each vision may not be true if he takes a different path.
Right. And I also enjoyed how they seemed to get clearer after he drank the water of life.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and that's because he now had the voices of all his ancestors on the male side and the female side.
That's right. Yeah, and that's how he found out he's a Harkerman as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is kind of cool.
And here's the thing. I'll agree with you, Eric. And you, I'm sure, I'm the person on the podcast who kind of hates the Vision thing. I don't usually like the way it's done. I often find it to be cheap and lazy and cheesy. I wasn't a fan of how it was implemented in the first film. And one of the reasons I had problems with the, even though I know it's part of the story and has to be done, was at the end, the last 20 minutes or so, it felt like getting smacked with Vision left and right. And it felt forced in a way, and I didn't care if it was just too much Vision stuff at the end of that, and they parceled it out and handled it much better, in my opinion, in this film than they did in the first one.
Yeah, sure.
And it wasn't quite, well, yeah, it's clear, but it wasn't like as clear. I think that was one of the problems I had, was that the Visions were basically just showing the footage they shot for that scene later. It was a little too on the nose, I think, of what he was saying. But that's me. That's just my take on it.
Well, and I think you're right. I mean, the first movie is most certainly the weaker of the two in all ways.
And it's still a really good fucking movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's just amazing that the movie is that good for what is set up and no promise of a payoff. Or at least no guarantee of a payoff.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Well, another high part I wanted to bring up, you know, you mentioned Javier Bardem, Mike. I want to say Josh Brolin was awesome in this film. I thought when he appeared and I don't know, it just reminded me of how great of an actor that he is. Kind of reminded me of back of the No Country for Old Men when he almost broke out to become like a superstar. And this role here, even though it was a smaller role, his character being stoic and all that, and if you hadn't read the book, you would think that maybe he was going to be the red shirt or the hero that dies at the end or something like that. But, you know, fortunately that doesn't happen. And as an actor, I think he hit it out of the ballpark, even more so in this movie than in the first. But that's just my thoughts.
I think everybody in this movie was solid.
Yeah.
I mean Zendaya, unfortunately, is the weakest link. But I don't think, like, if we were watching her in a different movie, I don't think she's bad. I just think she's the weakest one here because everybody here is really, really strong.
Well, yeah. And I think her scripting is not as good. I think that really hampers her.
Yeah. Well, and I agree with you about her being pouty. I will grant that. I was expecting you to complain, which I've seen some people do, about her being the resisting voice, and that she was opposed to Paul. And that I didn't have a problem with. But, yeah, but I will agree with you that she's – and I hadn't really thought about it. But, yes, she's a touch on the pouty side.
Right. And again, I feel it's also removing the whole common law wife part of her character from the book. That if they had left all that in, I don't think written this way.
That goes back to them compressing the time and having all this happen in a couple of months. And – I also don't think it helps that every time we see her, like, because she makes the comment about, you know, we're Fremen, everyone, men and women are equals, but really we only see her socializing and interacting with her girlfriend. and they're teasing each other, and that's fine, because that's what people do, but it adds to the feeling of it being teenagers, like at lunchtime.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if they were talking about something other than teasing her about her dreamboat, obviously they don't use that term. If you had scenes, if she had, and again, time, you know, if they had had a child together, if they had lost a child, if she had a conversation about having a child with someone else, where they were having a conversation about the relationship that wasn't about her, you know, crushing hard on Dreamy McMody face, right? It's just that could have helped give her the impression of being a more mature character. Because I will say, one of the things I liked about the first film was Timothée Chalamet. I think he gave a very good performance, but he's also in the book, he's supposed to be 15. I feel like Kyle MacLachlan was probably like 28 to 30 in the original Dune.
Yeah.
And here he feels not, if not 15, he certainly feels under, like he's probably under 18. And now obviously it's been a couple of years since he made the first Dune when they started filming this. And there was a whole pandemic thing in between there, but he feels like he's an older person. He feels like he's grown from the first film. He feels more mature.
He's hardened.
And he's hardened.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is his performance. I'm sure some of it is in the makeup and the lighting and the costuming. There's a whole bunch of reasons why that's the case. I just don't think that I ever felt that she matured with him, which would have been
not at all.
Well, yeah. They also made her leader of the Fedayeen, which is not in the book, but I'm fine with that. But they're supposed to be the baddest of the bad of the Fremen fighters. And I don't think that they do a good job of showing that. She's just some leader of some group.
Right. And, also,
if that's the case, and not a thing I was thinking about while watching the movie, but since you brought it up, they make sure to show us, see Paul kicking ass. I don't really remember seeing a lot of her kicking ass.
They did that one fight when they fight the Sandcrawler, whatever it's called. The spice.
Where she got the initial one.
The harvester.
Where she got the rocket launcher and stuff, and they were kicking the shit out of people. I thought they showed her pretty strongly there.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, but it could have also just been that when there were fights, you know, they were all wrapped up in robes and right. Face masks and turbans.
Yeah.
So that specific
fight. Barrett is spot on. But I did feel that her character and her, you know, wishy, you know, quote unquote, loving him and wishy-washy with him as well as the Messiah. It was weird because if she, like in the book, wants to, doesn't care about the Messiah because it's holding them back and let's just do it. Now that she has the Messiah, and she has Javier Bardem and all these other the Southerners all on board. You would think she would, even if she didn't believe it, similar to how Paul Atreides and the Josh Brolin character not necessarily believed it either. But they said, you know, let's just use it. And she is either too immature or too stupid that, or just too anti-Southerner that she refuses to say, yeah, let's just use it, even if it's not true. And instead, she's all pouty, and it was just weird. I don't know. That was, like I said, it was just the weakest part. But again, I feel it's just how they portrayed the character in the script for a movie version versus, you know, a large book version or a miniseries.
But, well, I think they worried too hard about her being a foil to Paul. Like I said, they could have made her question what he did while still being supportive of him. But instead, they chose it to make it very visual to everyone. Like, everyone around him would be like, you should be killed because you're talking treason against the Messiah, you know? Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And they also had her, I don't know. It just seemed like she would have been smart enough to know, oh, let's use this Messiah thing. And she didn't, but I don't know.
Well, not everyone's willing to make that sacrifice to use their people to use a Messiah idea that they don't believe in. I mean, that's really cynical. And I didn't see her being a cynical character.
Well, that's true. But it also, like Mike mentioned, which is she felt the Messiah was holding them back. But actually now, if they do have a Messiah, that actually gives them the motivation. And that's what she wanted the whole time.
Well, and that's one of the weird things about this movie version versus the book is that the Fremen all believe this. It's not there is some of them might have lesser degrees of belief, but right. They don't know that it's come from the Bene Gesserit. They don't have any clue of that. So right. That being added in changes the story a bit.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So once you make that change, you're
that might have been sort of like the playing down of the sexuality of the Harkonnens. That might have been a bow to modern culture, which is more secular than it would have been 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. Well, at least in the West, I guess. But yeah.
West.
That's true. All right. So let's see. Now, where do we want to go? Anybody else have some other stuff they wanted to bring up?
No, just real quick. No, I thought the one scene where they were attacking one of the mining machines.
Yeah, the harvester.
I particularly liked the, I guess they were magnetic explosives.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those were cool.
Those were pretty cool.
Yeah, that was when they were attacking Josh Brolin's ship, Gurney Halleck's ship, because they thought it was part of the Harkonnen, and then they found out it wasn't. It's like, oh,
yeah,
it's us.
Those explosive things were pretty cool.
They were pretty friggin' awesome, yeah.
Well, and I was reading somebody saying something about a shield on one of the ornithopters. What was that?
Oh, I was just saying that I thought it was awesome that Brolin actually showed Harvester. That was pretty awesome. He was a sharpshooter as well.
Yeah. I was going to say, I read something about when we were talking about shields earlier, and I read something about how people were noticing that the Harvester's shield went off before the rocket hit it or something. But I didn't notice any of that, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's like Mike said. It was just weird that the Harvester ships didn't have the shields. It was strange, and they didn't have enough protection around them either. It was kind of strange.
Well, I don't think. Well, and I hate to keep saying it in the book, but I don't think they could be bigger than personal in there. I don't think ornithopters had them.
Right. Yeah, that could be true. Yeah, and it could be wrong. Well, and even if you're right, they just didn't explain it in the movie, again, probably for time reasons or something.
Yeah.
Or hoping that people wouldn't notice or something. I did love, because I had forgotten all about it, I having read the book so long ago and seeing the movies and miniseries a long time ago, that they found the nukes. That was awesome. The atomics.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Because once you get that, that changes everything. And it really did. It changed everything.
Well, and it's a big deal because it's a huge treaty not to use those things.
Right.
And using them violates the constitution of the whatever, the lords, to do that. So by using those, they violate their own things.
Right. But it's fair for them to disobey because the emperor...
I was going to say, was it against the law for them to wipe out his entire family?
Exactly.
Only if you get caught.
Right. Yeah, and they get caught. So I'm
curious.
If they're going to break the law, we'll break the law too and use the nukes.
I'm curious what everyone pulled me out of it. I feel like there could have been a better actor for that role.
For which role?
The Emperor. I thought Christopher Walken is fine, but I felt
like I was trying not to hear it. But there was a little bit of this going on. I was like,
No.
Well, I honestly, the Emperor and Christopher Walken is a great actor. We all know that and whatnot. And yeah, he does have his quirks. I had no problems with him there. The only issue I think I would have had if I did about his character is I always portrayed the Emperor as much younger. And Christopher Walken in real life is like 80 years old. And they didn't do what Scorsese has done in his last two movies with De Niro, where he unages him, and maybe they could have done that with Walken, and then I think it would have worked a little better. Even though I understand how you can get pulled out of a film when Walken talks, but I think it was more his age that threw me a loop than how he talked. But yeah.
Well, and yeah, I think he should have been younger. And the Emperor, I think, has red hair in the books. And Harkonnen, too, because they're all interrelated because of the breeding program.
Yeah, I see, like, the walk-in thing is funny because I read something where I saw one review where they said, you got Christopher Walken. Why didn't you have him do the walk-in thing? And and I think that's an interesting point, but I kind of like that he didn't be Christopher Walken. I feel like it's that they wanted someone iconic put in that role.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like Christopher Lee was in Lord of the Rings or whatever.
Christopher Lee, Jack Palance in Batman. You could pick a lot of examples, and I think they wanted someone who they could put there and who would play the part. And obviously, it's a choice to make him older.
Yeah, not a big deal, right?
And I don't think that's a big deal. I don't know how much of a role he has after this film. So maybe they didn't think the age was that important. Can Barrett, without being spoilery, does he have a big role in what's upcoming? Or is he going to spend the rest of his time on Elba?
He will spend the rest of his time there, but he does have a role to play.
But is it a role that's going to be like a major role that's going to require running and jumping and sword fighting?
No, you'll see some scenes with him. That's pretty much it. More machinations than anything else.
Yeah, and honestly,
he never leaves that planet ever again where he gets exiled to.
I'm kind of with you, Mike, too, that I felt him and how he portrayed it was fairly dignified as how he was rather than, you know, the gangster or the New Yorker or whatever that he would have had if he kept his famous voice.
What I think of is, like, if they'd gone and, like, Paul comes in and he's like, Paul, what are you doing? You know, if you'd gotten something like that, I was like, it would have been to me like the
Motive.
It would have been like the minister and Princess Bride going marriage, you know, and everyone just loses it. I think it would have taken me out of the movie if he had leaned into the Christopher Walken.
Absolutely, incident. He already pulled me out of it just because looking at him brings me out of it. It's just something about it
because he's so huge
and he's never really done a role like this before.
Yeah,
that I can think of.
Yeah, that's
right. I hate to say it, but at this point, I can't see the man and not hear in my head.
Cowbell?
I gotta have more cowbell.
Cowbell, exactly. Exactly.
Well, it is weird how, to me, I can look at, I don't know Timothée Chalamet, but I could look at Jason Momoa. I could look at
Dave Bautista, Josh Brolin.
And be perfectly fine with them in those roles, but there's just something about Christopher Walken. I'm going, that's Christopher Walken, you know, just like and part of it's probably because it'd be sort of like an Arnold Schwarzenegger or a Danny DeVito, is that he has become a pop culture icon unto himself beyond just being, you know,
an actor. God damn it, Mike. Now you've got me picturing Arnold Schwarzenegger in that role.
He'd be like Conan when he's the Emperor.
All right, get to the ornithopter.
Yeah. No, and that's a fair point, Mike. We've seen him play, you know, the Headless Horseman and Sleepy Hollow and stuff, and those aren't the typical Christopher Walken roles either. So it's fair. And
in fairness to the Headless Horseman, who's running around most of it without a head,
I had this uncomfortable watch stuck up my ass. Another role. I just watch. Can't separate him from this, that, you know?
This watch.
I had this gum jump. It's not yours. Back up my ass.
Oh, and then when he's talking to Dennis Hopper in True Romance.
Oh, that is a classic scene. Oh, my God. I love that scene.
My favorite scene is when he's in the hospital in Deer Hunter, and they say his name, Joseph Chodorovsky. Is that Russian? And he looks up at him, and he goes, no, it's American. I thought that was awesome. That's right. Damn right. You can be American with a Russian name. Damn right. Don't you ever say otherwise, you fuckers. Because they thought he was a spy, because he was like PTSD, wasn't speaking, and he was just staring at the wall, and then finally they ask him his name, and he and says, "You're yeah. are you a Russian?" And he figured out what they were doing, those fuckers. Great film. Dude. Great film.
Very good.
Let's see. So where else did we want to go on this one here? I was
we're talking about other movies now, so I think we're done.
Well, I was disappointed with the Baron because he's such a great villain, and I felt he was underused in this film.
But yeah, and that's why I said I just thought the Harkonnens as a whole were underdeveloped, and they just said, "How would you convince people they're really bad? Have them murder their underlings."
Yeah, I
did like the moment where he's cut down and he's lying on the steps at the end, and you just see him trying to crawl to the throne.
Yeah,
that was cool. Yeah.
As if he suddenly gets on the throne and he goes, "Emperor called it." Not
yeah, I didn't even know what he was doing. Why he was crawling away? I didn't even know what the hell was going on.
He's going for the throne.
That's what it meant. That's how I interpreted it. Whether that micro interpretation is correct, I'm not sure. The Zendaya thing walking away. To me, that was just her refusing to buy into his bullshit and hurt that he was and hurt that he chose somebody else. Like this is where I think she realizes what he was saying. The scene, and I'm sure it has parallels in other stories, where he's basically being forced into taking on his role, and he doesn't want to take on the role of Messiah. It did remind me of the story of Jesus at the wedding, where Mary's like, "Hey, could you make us some wine?" And he's like, "You know, it's not really my time yet. I really shouldn't be doing this quite now." And she's like, "Ah, I'll go do this." And it's like, "Oh, fuck!" And just accelerates the timeline. But that was kind of what it made me think of.
I think it does a good job of showing how cold you would become if you saw all possible futures. And like, he knows she's going to come back to him, so he has no worries. He doesn't have to be nice about it. He just becomes cold about it, you know? So find that. I like that a lot.
Well, yeah, sort of like how Jessica changes when she sees all the possible pasts. Yeah. Not all the pasts of the people. It's sort of like, I think, as how we get older, generally speaking. You have perspective, and you aren't like as excited for things maybe as you were when you were younger because you have perspective. And that means I think you're a little more mellow, and it doesn't mean that you don't enjoy things or hate things or you're just not like as hyper excited about things. And like, I'll just point to my kitten who, you know, when we got him, you know, he would do like 5 spins before he would get it on his way to his food bowl. And now we're lucky we only get one, and he's just barely a year old. He's mellowed completely. But he just knows, the food's coming. I don't have to get excited for the food anymore because I know I'm going to get it. Well, she's now experienced however many centuries of lifetimes that she has behind her, and this too will pass.
And he has double.
And now he not only has that, but he also has the hundreds of years in the future he's dealt with. Yeah. So, yeah, I think he gets that distance and that detachment. And, you know, just like a researcher isn't going to get too attached to a mouse that lives for a year, if you've envisioned hundreds of lifetimes, it's hard to get too wrapped up in just one.
Well, and I think it's good because it's going to show how he becomes a slave to being the emperor rather than being the emperor, right? It's a great position, not really. Because you become controlled.
Yeah, because you have to deal with all the whiners below you. But, you know, I know.
That's an old trope, right? And I think we've seen it in a lot of things, like Game of Thrones even. I think we see that there is a trap that comes with power and a responsibility that comes with power. But by the way, that is a thing that's touched on in the first film, where they know they're walking into a trap on Arrakis, but he can't say no.
Yep.
I did think it's funny. Sorry, Eric. reading the book, because the whole surprise trap, they literally lay it out for the reader in chapter two. It's like, there's no surprise at all. They say, all right, we're going to invade and we're going to get the support of the emperor. It's like, they're just, nope, we're going to lay it out. I was like,
there's a traitor.
No, they didn't just say there's a traitor. Here's a traitor. And it's Dr. Yui. It's like, you left no surprises. So I'm curious, like I said, I got to like the third chapter before I just got swamped.
Well, that's kind of cool that they do that, because they switch perspectives.
Yeah, but anyhow, that was Yui in the arena, right?
Yeah. Wasn't Yui killed in the first film?
He was killed. He sent him to his wife. Sent him to his wife.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right.
It was just
some
random Atreides.
It was just a different Asian guy.
Well, we lost track of Gurney Halleck too, because he just disappears. He's not in this movie at all.
No, that's not true. He's Josh Brolin's character.
Oh, not Gurney, the other guy.
The Mentat?
Yeah, the Mentat. Thufir.
Right. Well, because they just wrote out the Mentats. For whatever reason, and I don't know.
Thuther, is he even in the first one?
Yes.
Yeah. Who played him?
The guy from Severance.
Severance.
I say this knowing that Phil is not watching.
Phil doesn't know it. Yeah.
Severance was the show on Apple TV that Eric and I tried to insist that you watch.
It's really good.
What's the actor's name? Oh yeah, Thuther. Yeah, Stephen McKinney Henderson, right?
If you say so.
he's kind of chubby guy.
Yeah,
chubby light skinned black guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was going to say the albino guy, similar to the one that the black guy that's an albino in real life that was in Halo. I think it may have been the same actor, wasn't it? I don't even know.
No, I don't think it was. Yeah.
No, because what's his face is the.
Let me guess. You're saying all albino black guys look alike.
No, I am not saying that.
Yeah. I mean, we are limiting some of the possibilities with the two, you know, with every qualifier you put on there. Because in fairness, they're also both older, fat albino black guys.
Yeah, right. And they both had like the beard thing going on too. But yeah, what happened to him? Yeah, why did they kill him? Or did make him disappear? I mean, because we don't even know if he does. Right? In the book, does he die in the book? I don't even remember.
I suspect that's probably a case of
Cutting room floor.
Of cutting room floor, that would be my guess. Or maybe
he's taken by the Harkonnens in the book.
Yeah, it could just be. And in the Lynch movie, he's made to milk a cat.
Yes, but even in the book, I mean, he's taken by the Harkonnens and made to work for them because their Mentat is killed, if you recall.
Peter.
Yeah. When Duke pushes the poison out.
Oh, yeah, that's David Malshian's character, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He gets killed during the poison scene. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So then they need a Mentat, because Mentats are not cheap. So the Baron likes to have them enslaved to him.
So who became the Mentat in this movie? There was none, right?
There was none. Never see any. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but in the book, does he replace him? Because I can't even remember.
Does he replace who?
Peter DeVries.
Yes, he replaces him in the book.
Okay.
He's basically taken by the Baron and made to do whatever he wants him to.
Gotcha.
He's there at the very end when Paul takes over.
Oh, okay. So they just wrote it out.
He has his own plots going on. Like he helps Fade try and do an assassination on the Baron in the book.
Oh, right. Interesting.
Okay, here's
but those one. That would have been way too many plots. They didn't, you know, they did a very small amount of the Harkonnen planet as it was. You couldn't have done all that and maintained a 2.5-hour movie. Right. It would have been really long.
Yeah, indeed.
Back to the we're going to make sure they're evil, so they're evil. the fact that for Fade, that they drugged the arena contestants, I think I would have been perfectly fine if they hadn't, because they were trying to show he's a badass. I don't think they. I think they could have just shown him taking the shit out of people and not have to use the trope of the bad guys also cheat.
I guess, but they cheat in the book, so.
Yeah, I get it. I'm just saying it would have. Again, it's like you want to make sure we know he's a match for Paul. And what all we see him do really is beat up a, besides, you know, getting a little uncomfortable.
Two drug guys and a guy that's thin.
That's half starved to death.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
So that's that. And again, that nitpick, minor nitpick.
Right. Does that make him that big of a villain or not? Right. I see where you're coming. Let me ask you this about him though. I loved how the Benny Jesuit said that, this guy's a sociopath. Cluster B, they actually say it. It was awesome. That was one thing. But
they
also,
didn't say Cluster B. They did not say Cluster B.
They did say psychopath or sociopath. So
He is a sociopath, yes. Yeah. And that's the other thing. I think they went a little far in the portrayal of his character because I just cannot believe that Benny Jesuit looked at him and went, yeah, no, he's good. He's fine. He'll do.
Yeah.
Now she gets pregnant by him. Is that character take the baby have any importance in the new books, the next two books?
No.
Okay.
I read somewhere that's not in the book.
Yeah.
It is. It is in the book actually.
That she gets pregnant by him, but the baby never has.
Yeah,
a role.
They purposely are using him as a breeding person, and she is the one that gets pregnant by him.
Okay, but the character, the baby, has no importance.
No bearing, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I was wondering about that. Because I was wondering why
they
even happened.
Well, it's a good thing they took time out of the story to tell us that.
Well, that's why I was confused. It's like, that part went nowhere, so it must have to do something to do with the next part.
Interesting part is she's married to Count Fenring, who is a failed Kwisatz Haderach. So, but he's not in the movies. I think he did hit the cutting room floor. I'm not sure I'm not for sure that they did scenes with him, but I thought I had read something about that.
Interesting.
And he's a close personal friend to the Emperor, but he won't fight for the Emperor at the very end, and that's why Fade does.
Oh, interesting. So he was written out completely, the character.
Yeah.
Right. Now, are these people that are married to the Benny Jesuits cucks or something? Because they allow their woman to get pregnant by just random losers like Fed?
That is the Benny Gesserit. They go out and they breed, and they're supposed to only have whatever gender they're assigned, female or male.
All right, guys, I gotta go.
Mostly female.
All right. See you, Eric.
Bye. All right. Talk to you later, Eric. Bye. But does that mean that it's okay for them to have children from people that aren't their husbands then?
Yeah. Okay. Whoever the breeding plan is part of is who they're supposed to have kids with.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and it's all like, because they're in the she is supposed to have, Jessica was supposed to have a daughter. The daughter was supposed to marry Fade, and that would have united the two houses. And then she royally fucks everything up by not having a daughter.
And she makes the Kwisatz Haderach come sooner than they were ready for.
Ew, that's dirty.
Yeah. That is dirty. Not meant that way, though.
Right. So, that's interesting. That whole thing.
That whole thing, there's a definite creepiness to the way that Benny Jesuit look at
operate
and look at, you know, what we in our primitive 21st century customs, way we look at like marriage and childbearing, as opposed to the really weird ass way they look at it, which is as, you know, manipulating empires and planning centuries ahead of time of manipulating bloodlines.
Yep.
And when you say, like, is he a cuck for letting them? I think that's just they have a lot of power, and I think to some degree they decide who's going to And actually, it's not Mary, right? It's a consort.
Right, it's a consort.
Right, because
he never marries her. Yeah,
yeah.
He never marries, but she's a consort. Right. So that if you're that, I think they're going to get your sperm one way or another.
Yep.
Better just to screw them because you don't want to get.
And I don't know that you even remember it afterwards. That's the thing.
Oh, that's fine.
I don't think Baron remembers that Jessica's her father. You know that he's her father.
Well, he looks literally is looking down at her, right? Mm-hmm. As an infant, and he's taking joy in her. So on some level, I would think he has to.
Yeah, I guess in the movie that's how it's portrayed, but I don't think in the books that he knows.
Also, fair point.
Right, that's true. Yep. All right.
Because they don't want them to know who they're breeding and who becomes who. They keep it all secret, but they have their whole genetic line stuff, you know, right. Kept. And I think that's where you start getting into the computer stuff. Like they have computers, I think, secret computers, so they can keep track of the genetic stuff, stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, and that's another thing that's interesting about this film, too, or this story that's just weird, is we have all this advanced technology, and then you have all these primitive people on the planet down below with mysticism and religion and all this other stuff. And I don't mean that as a negative. It's just that it's like a black and white of the two, you know, because if you just watch half the film, meaning the Freeman part of the film, you wouldn't even know that computers even existed. It's kind of
well, they don't really, because they've killed, because of AI at some point, they've destroyed all computers. And that's why there's human mathematic, you know, the Mentats are meant to bridge that gap and be able to. And see, that's how the spice interconnects everything. The spice is used to make Mentats. The spice is used to make Reverend Mothers. And the spice is used to keep people alive longer. So, and the Guild Navigators.
And the spice
why. Yeah, that's why they're all such important pieces of the whole puzzle.
Right. Now, let's see. Anything else that we want to talk about?
I'm trying to think. I will say, still miss the worm design from the original film.
I agree. Oh, yes, you're right.
And the reason is literally the mouth, right? Because really, what's the big difference? It's a freaking worm.
Mm-hmm.
And this could very much be the reason why. But by not giving it that articulated jaw or reway jaw in the original film, and I've, by the way, I want to say when I was younger, like, and I looked at covers for Dune, the worms were painted, like they had the worm painted on the cover for Dune, like was probably the most popular crate paperback cover I had seen. It had that kind of jaw, but I don't know if that's where the movie got it from or if they got that from the movie. So I'm not really sure about that. But for me, it's really just that it gives it a face and it gives it a personality. It makes it more menacing. And this makes it, without that jaw, it makes it more impersonal. And that might have been what they were going for, to make it more of a, feel like more of a force of nature. And more distant and removed and more alien. And in which case, that's fine. I just personally, it's not my preference. And it does not mean I think these are bad. They certainly work well.
Yeah, that was the most incredible thing about the film, though, was the IMAX part of the sound for the worms was fucking amazing.
Oh, the sound, I saw it in IMAX the first time. The second time I watched it last night was in a regular theater. And, yeah, the sound is just, I'm not saying that it's good sound. I am saying it is loud sound.
I don't know, in IMAX, I could feel everything about that worm passing me by, and it was amazing.
Oh, yeah, I could. I mean, it's if you have gone to an AMC theater any time in the last 3 years, since the pandemic, they did this. They did this. They've done this thing with Nicole Kidman, like that's promoting going to the movies.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. We don't have any AMCs.
And one of the wines is, you know, with sound you can feel. And that was, I just couldn't get that out of my mind while I was watching Dune. By the way, they need to change it. It's been 3 years. I go to 50 movies a year. I've seen it over 150 times. they've updated the movie. They've updated the movies on the screen, but it's still Nicole Kidman giving the same freaking speech.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing. It was still very loud, even on regular screen as well.
Absolutely.
But the worms, to go back to the worms, you know what they kind of reminded me of? In this here, they reminded me of the Sarlacc in Return of the Jedi. Kind of. Something like that.
The original.
Yeah.
But technically, they're before the Sarlacc. Well, are they before the... Yeah, they would be before the Sarlacc.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, but wait.
Oh, yeah, well, this was... Well,
yeah, so the Sarlacc... Totally but I mean, this specific design of the worm...
Yeah.
Reminded me of the Sarlacc. Because, again, you know, the book, obviously, the interpretation of the worm in all three versions...
Well,
of this,
the ones in David Lynch's looked like penises, so I'm glad we don't have that.
Well, you know what else looks like penises? Worms.
That's true.
Yep. I mean, there's a reason for all that.
Which is the one that has, or hot dogs? Which is the one that has the jaw you were talking about, Mike?
The one from the David Lynch.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, where it's where the mouth, where the head comes together like a penis, right? And it's got the three jaws. Yeah. Right? Is it three or is it four?
Four. I think it's four. Now I don't remember. Now I'm questioning it.
Yeah, right. So here is a here's a great example of the Mandela effect. No, it's four. No, it's three. That's like, oh, no, five. Shit, it turned out it's five.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
But the idea is like when the mouth closed, it comes together at a point where this is just, it feels like it's a vacuum tube sucking up things in the desert. And biologically, I understand why that makes perfect sense.
Now,
I'm not saying it's a terrible design. I'm just saying I prefer the one that had more personality.
Now, for one scene I liked was when Javier Bardem was supposed to be killed, because that's how the tradition is for the Freeman, and Paul changes that tradition, which I thought was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Because
there's some traditions that are fucking stupid.
Yeah, yep. And that's one of them. Yep.
Why would I give up my left arm before I go into battle? That's dumb.
Yeah,
I'm not doing that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and plus, it was probably multiple things. Obviously, he liked the man, and the man was a good warrior, but also he knew that was a guy that wasn't ever going to betray him either. You know, so some of it could have been self-serving, but the point is why kill the guy? Because he's your buddy, even no matter what the reason is. Anything else? Anyone?
I don't think I have anything else.
There are little things I'd like you talk about the society. I like the fact that while these were desert people living in caves, they had modern technology, right? They're making these thumpers. There's underneath the robes, they're wearing modern clothing. That it's not simply, oh, look at these primitive people who are living just like the desert people lived 12,000 years ago.
Which they're not supposed to be. They're supposed to be just the way they live is for the planet.
Right. But,
yeah, to survive the way, without the waters and all that.
But I guess I'm just saying it's, I like the fact that they're primitive from a modern, from a futurist perspective, which is still fairly advanced.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool, because whether or not a lot of that technology they invented or it was brought to them, The point is, similar to Native Americans or American Indians or whatever the term you want to use, indigenous or whatever, those folk, when the Spaniard and everybody showed up, the Dutch and so forth, they started using muskets and they started using horses. And, you know, they adapt and take the technology, similar to, say, Japan after World War II. They started taking cars and saying, all right, we can do this too. We can make TVs too. We can, you know, so it makes sense. But yeah, go on, Barrett.
one of the reasons that they don't know there's so many Fremen is because they're using spice to bribe the guild so that the satellites in the southern region don't work. Don't see them.
Right, there you go.
Yep. They're making more money on their own spice harvesting than probably the Harkonnens.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yep. That is true.
But I do wonder, for all we see of the world, like, where are their factories? How are they making these things? Like, where do they make their still suits? Where do they make their thumpers?
Right.
And again, it's...
I mean, so
it trades for hours 45
yeah,
minutes.
It could have been traded.
I don't want to go into the socioeconomic underpinnings of the Fremen society.
I think it's traded.
And, yeah, and their labor guild and all the rest. Or how they go.
Suits, I would think they have to make still suits. I don't think they would trust other people to make those. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Yeah. What are they eating?
What are they farming? There's another. Yeah, you know, we see them eating some thing, right? That's spice in it.
Yeah. But what is it? Yeah, right.
But was it Maudib? Were they eating Maudib? Take of my flesh? Is that what they were doing?
Right, exactly.
Right, yeah. I mean, were they eating the desert?
Or worms. Right.
Or worm droppings.
Yeah.
Ew.
Which maybe that's the spice. Mm.
Yeah, or maybe the spice is enough, you know.
Oh, that's actually something I should point out that I liked was the harvesting of the goo juice from the worm.
Oh, right. Yeah, the small worm. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
I wonder if that would be considered a sand trout because they have the smaller ones. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. Is that a baby or is it like you said, a different species?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, the sand trout eventually turn into the sandworms, but they're not allergic to the water like the worms are, because the worms die via water.
Right, so I guess
that's not a sand trout because that one dies when they give it the water, and that's how they get the water of life.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. But again, that wasn't explained, I think, well enough in the movie, so I'm confused about that. Yeah. Anything else?
I wanted to see a centipede.
Oh, that would have been awesome. Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Yep. Like
the little centipede. Ones. Is it the little ones? The one,
the ones you have to worry about. Yeah.
So oh yeah,
and he's holding his hand about a foot and a half.
Yes. Apart.
Yeah, he goes. The big ones, they're harmless, but the little ones, and the little ones are still pretty big.
Yeah,
you got to watch out for them. Never mind the sand spiders too.
Yeah.
Or the pit spiders, or whatever the hell he called them.
Yeah. Trap door spiders. I
think. Yeah, yeah, drop door spiders. Yeah. I think I'm done. Anyone else?
Yeah, I'm good.
The only other thing I think of noticing is the ship design. And I'll say something. There's not a lot that I prefer. Removing nostalgic goggles of the original film. Like, there's still things I love about the original film. I recognize there's a lot of flaws in it. They've got a fantastic cast that is doing some very hammy acting. I like a lot of the art design, the visuals, and I love the music. I definitely kind of prefer some of the ship designs in the original. But one of the things I liked here is looking at it is the Atreides ships seem to be a little more angular, where the Harkonnen ships are all these like bulbous round things. There's that the one ship we see early on that looks like a pair of boobs hanging in the sky, or maybe a pair of testicles, depending on which you prefer. The harvester transport looks like a loaded tick floating in the air.
Yeah.
So I thought those are interesting because that those are unique designs that I don't think I've ever seen for vehicles and vessels, and they're clearly going for a specific aesthetic choice. In the Harkonnen designs, the only real ship, we don't see a lot of ships from the Atreides point of view. except they use the ornithopters, which are thinner and more angular, and then we see the Harkonnens using them later, but I don't know if that's their ornithopters or they're just stealing the ones that the Atreides left behind.
Fair question.
Yep. I am not sure.
Anywho.
Since we don't have the guild, we don't know which ships are theirs and which are the Atreides. Like, I know that the royal houses have their own ships, and they, like, go on board the guild of Highliners, but, yeah, they don't really show us that, so.
You're right. Let's see. Anything else? All right, sounds good. So we're pretty much done talking about the film, so just a couple of quick things. Barrett, what's that other podcast that me and you do, and we have a rotating co-host that join us?
Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews. We were just talking about doing an episode about hard sci-fi versus other sci-fi. Stay tuned.
Yep, that could be interesting. And Mike, what's that other podcast that myself, you, and our co-host Eric do?
That is the Cinema a la Carte podcast, which is, wait, is that the one you wanted?
Yeah, that's right. Keep going on.
Okay. Sorry. We do too many podcasts. Cause everyone's like, wait, no, we do another podcast with Eric, which is this one. Right. We're on this one. This is the one we're on now, not the other one. I'm sorry. Yeah. My brain is a bit sleep deprived, in the middle of too many podcasts. So it is the Cinema a la Carte podcast, where we discuss movies that are not necessarily dark discussions material, things like Jack Reacher or Forbidden Planet or History of Violence. They still tend to have a dark edge because we are who we are. But we also did lighter fare like Risky Business and Inside Out. So we take turns picking movies. Phil has picked the next film for us to do, which is going to be sports related, since we're heading into baseball season. And it's good because it's a movie I weirdly have never seen, even though it's been on my list of movies to see. So it's on my bucket list, and I'll be happy to see it. And hopefully soon you'll be able to hear us talk about it.
Indeed. And Barrett, what's that podcast that me, you, Mike, and Sean Fox do about a television series?
Cortana's Communiques, based on the Halo TV series, season 2.
Yep, indeed. And then we also just wrapped up a podcast called Bo Hancock and One Piece, which was about the Netflix television series One Piece, based off of the anime and manga. All right. Oh, and then co-host Eric, who had to drop off because he had a set time limit tonight to record before he had to leave. He does the Ascancity podcast, which is Ascancity, with his buddy Dan, which talks about general topics in the news, whether it's entertainment, politics, medicine, music, you name it. They talk about it. All right, so let's give our final thoughts on this film here. So Barrett, why don't you start?
Thanks for joining us on this week's
I asked Barrett, let's give your final thoughts on this film here.
Oh, my final thoughts, sorry, my brain just broke. I like this movie a lot. I do think it is a masterpiece of film. My only issues with it are all book related and how it was adapted, and I can get past those. So.
All right. Sounds good. For me, it was a pretty solid film. Really good film. Well done. I think this is a hit for obvious reasons. I actually was surprised that it was going to be a hit because I wasn't sure if it would work for a mainstream audience, but it sure did. And rightfully so, is a hit because it is a great film. So recommend. Mike?
Yeah, it's a really good film. Like I said, there's little things about it that I would love. But the problem is it's taking a book with a lot of stuff in it and you just can't get it all in there in that time. And so they have to cut some corners. And that's, as you've often heard us say, certainly heard me say on the podcast, that's what it means to be an adaptation. You have to adapt for the medium. And I think most of the choices they made, I either agree with, or even if I don't agree with it, I certainly understand it. And I think what they've created is an entertaining piece of fiction that really moves for a 2.5 hour movie, 2-hour and 45-minute movie that I enjoyed a great deal. And I will probably be watching again. And I'm really kind of looking forward to, and see it in theaters. Please see it in theaters. But once it's out on 4K, I'll be watching it at home and probably doing a double feature with the original. And I really am hoping that there might be some sort of extended cut, because I suspect there's probably a lot of material that
Snyder Dune cut.
Yeah, the Snyder cut. Or just do like what Tarantino has done and never shown to fucking American audiences, you asshole, and recut Kill Bill 1 and 2 into the ultimate.
Or what they did with The Godfather when they brought it to TV.
Oh, that was amazing. One and two together? Yeah. I wish I could buy that. I want it.
Yeah, actually, I think it was available somewhere at one point. I would have to look it up, though. But, yeah, it was amazing.
I watched it when it was on HBO, and I kept looking for it to be available, and I never saw it available.
Bastard.
Yeah.
Anything else, Mike?
Nope, that's it.
All right, sounds good. So, once again, this film is called Dune Part 2, which is the second in obviously the series, directed by, and I'm going to screw up his name again, Denis Villeneuve, sorry, Quebecer. Screenplay by him as well as John Spates, starring Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Josh Brolin, Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, Dave Bautista, Christopher Walken, Leigh Seydoux, Sohila Yacoub, Stellan Skarsgård, Charlotte Rampling, Javier Bardem. Music by Hans Zimmer, edited by Joe Walker, cinematography by Greg Frazier, and yeah, that's pretty much it. So check it out. It's at theaters as of March 14th, 2024. And with all that stated, since you almost jumped the gun, Barrett, why don't you read this out?
Thanks for joining us this week on Dark Discussions. Join us next week when we have something completely different.